I can't explain the honor I have of introducing my next guest on Women in What We Do. When I started this podcast, it was so important to me to share the amazing stories of triumph, empowerment, and strength of women in our community to inspire us all on who and what we can be. My next guest has spent her entire life advocating for women and educating human rights around the globe. She is the brilliant author of a book, Citizen of the World, where she urges us all to look through the world through women's eyes, to understand why gender equality and women's empowerment, particularly in the poorest and most vulnerable populations, is essential to our collective good. She also touches on ending violence against women and girls, finding Earth's balance, claiming the rights to social and economic development, collective voices are changing the world, and so much more. She currently serves as the United Nations representative of the International Alliance of Women and is also the chair of the board of the Women's Environment and Development Organization, We Do. I could go on and on with her accolades and accomplishments, but instead I will just introduce you to our incredible guest, Dr. Shun Young Yoon. I'm Mary Brucker, your host, and welcome. Like I said, she really needs no other introduction. I am so grateful, as I know all of our listeners are, to hear the story of my next guest, Dr. Shun Young Yoon. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you, Mary.
We are so honored to have you. I can't wait for people to hear your story, what you've been through, what you're doing now, and just the inspiration that you are. I know by myself alone as being a woman and the work that you're doing around the world. So I just want to start by saying welcome. And if you don't mind, just give us a little brief history of how you got started in this amazing world of women empowerment.
Women empowerment. So one of my husband's favorite questions when he meets someone is, who was the most influential person in your life? And often it would be a teacher or maybe a first employer who said something and got them on the right track. In my case, it was somebody I never met, something that that brought this person real to us in our family were family stories. Family stories about a grandfather who in the late 19th, early 20th century in Pyongyang, North Korea, growing up in a very traditional Confucian patriarchal environment, was living under Japanese occupation. And he decided that the only way that Korea could strengthen itself would be through economic development. But he only had three daughters and one son. At a time when all of the influence and all the property, all of the power would have gone to the eldest son. And because he didn't have that, he decided that he was going to educate all his daughters. So he sent my mother to the United States, to Chicago, to the American Conservatory, because he loved Chopin. And she was a pianist, and so she got a degree from American Conservatory with the mission of bringing Western music back to Korea. My aunt, her older sister, went to Tokyo School of Medicine. Eventually, because she was imprisoned by the colonial power and required to leave the country, went to the University of Michigan and got her PhD in public health from
Your
the university.
Aunt.
My aunt, in 1924.
Okay.
1924. So those are the stories that came to me as a child. And so in a way, I can take absolutely no credit for thinking about women's empowerment because it was given to my mother and then it was given to me. And so I encourage everyone who's a mother to give it to their children.
Right. And to talk a little bit about when you knew that this was going to be kind of your path. I know in college, you were a little rebel with a cause is what I've...
How did you learn about that?
I may have read a little bit up on you. So where did that drive start?
So I can only tell you the markers. Okay, so I finished my French literature degree after studying my junior year abroad. University of Michigan has a junior year abroad program in Aix-en-Provence. So I went there. I was doing literature. I came back and decided that I knew French well enough to not do it for graduate school. So I applied to the Department of Anthropology and entered the anthropology department. And from there, I didn't drift into a PhD. In my family, getting a PhD was sort of like people getting a high school degree. We have 4 PhDs in my family. And it was a natural thing to do because, like that tradition that my grandfather gave on the importance of education, I grew up with that idea. And I also grew up with the idea that that education was a privilege, and once you have it, you have to give back.
Right.
So again, it was given to me, the idea. And so when I graduated and talked with my advisor, Marshall Solins, he said, you know, if I pick up the phone and call my friends at Stanford, they'll give you an interview for a job as a professor at Stanford. And I said, I really want to work for the UN. Could you do something about that? And he said, no, you're going to ruin your career if you go to the UN. I said, yeah, but I'm supposed to give back, and anthropology is about the world, and Stanford is not.
Right.
That was sort of my way of really arguing with my advisor, saying, I really need to be in a place where I can learn more about the world. So I left Michigan State and went to my first faculty meeting there. I hope they'll forgive me for this. And at the faculty meeting, one of my first, they said, you know, our mission here at the faculty, that our faculty in our department is to improve our reputation. I said, okay, that's all right. I'm happy to be involved in that. They said, well, we're going to do it by upping the standards of our student admissions. And I thought, isn't that mostly like at Harvard and other places? Don't they like talk about faculty papers and books? And that was not their focus. Their focus was to make the requirements for their students much more strict. And I said, I'm out of here.
Right.
I can't do this.
Because you had a different
mindset. That's not my mission.
Right.
That's not my mission.
So what was your mission?
You know, when you're in that situation, you don't know what your mission really is. You know what fits. You know how it makes you feel when you end the day. And you know if you thought that day was a useful day, right? So I grabbed the first chance I had to meet with the president of Ewha Women's University. Ewha Women's University, at the time, was the largest women's university in the world. Today, we have 25,000 students in Seoul. She happened to be visiting family friends in Detroit on her mission to create a foundation. And I said, can I come and talk to you? And they said, okay, you know, she's a family friend. So I said, can I come and teach at Ewha Women's University? Because I need to be at a place that I'm going to learn something more about a different culture, because that's my field, and where I feel as though maybe I'll be useful. She said, come. She wanted English speakers, because my Korean's terrible. So she wanted English speakers, and I applied for Fulbright from the U.S. and was able to, therefore, go and teach at Ewha Women's University. And that was my leap out of the United States into the developing world.
Okay. And you, as I described in your introduction, now are with the UN. How does one get into the UN and start that global work?
Well, you know, my LinkedIn profile is the most accurate, which says, I work for the UN and sometimes I get paid.
Right.
Really true. So the work that I did in the UN for UNICEF at the regional office in Southeast Asia was on the, you know, hands-on. The work I did with the World Health Organization in New Delhi, covering 10 countries on health, that was a lot of travel hands-on. The work I do now is more like a senior advisor, unpaid volunteer work, quite frankly. It's important to know that there are such people like that in the UN system. We provide advisory role in many ways, but the UN is not the budget that you pay the UN from the US, which is the largest amount paid by other countries, doesn't necessarily pay all these volunteer advisors. But I also am connected with a group called the International Alliance of Women. We're an alliance of 200 organizations all over the world, with Francophone Africa being a very big part. I'm also involved with a group called the Coalition for the UN We Need. And we just finished this meeting in Nairobi where we talked about the future of the UN. And so those are the exciting things that I feel I'm doing. But if you want to know more details, just ask me. there are a lot of details.
I'm obsessed with your book. I just watched a TED Talk that you did, which I want to talk about. The title of that is How to Peel Back an Onion Without Crying. And at first I read it, I'm like, I cry every time I peel back an onion, but there has to be something to this. Explain what you mean by how to peel back an onion without crying.
Apparently that was the worst title I could give it, because one of the first comments was from this Vietnamese woman or someone who said, I really thought I was going to learn how to peel an onion without crying.
It's a little deeper than that.
Yeah. No, it came from the idea that when I traveled around the world, I was very seldom given the identity that I really am. North Korean born, raised in Michigan. The only time that I was actually identified as a North Korean was in Czechoslovakia, where there were a lot of North Korean students at the time. Otherwise, when I lived in Thailand, they thought that I was a Japanese tourist who didn't speak Thai very well. Not speaking Korean well in Korea, they thought I was from Thailand. And I think in the book, or maybe in my TED Talk, I talk about when I was on the border of Lebanon and Jordan, they caught me at the border, and suddenly I was traveling with a Palestinian couple who worked for the Rami actually worked for the, was connected with the Jordanian Air Force. I was traveling with my foreign car in order to get tax-free status to go back to Lebanon. So I'm traveling with this couple in my French Peugeot, going across very innocently to Jordan with the intention of coming back in a week. And suddenly I found myself surrounded by these guys with these big guns. And they made us get out of the car, and for about 3 hours they tore apart my car. I never realized that in a French car the inside of the front door can be torn out. And they broke into everything I had in my luggage. They gave us a really hard time. Why? Because the week before, a Japanese woman had come into Jordan with a Palestinian couple and bombed the hotel. So, you know me, like, I wasn't scared. I was mad. Right. So I said, do you think that we are going to do this again, the same hotel? I said, this is not going to happen. And they continued, and we got out of it because Rami called up to the top of the Air Force in Jordan, and we were freed from that. But the funniest part was when the guy with the biggest gun said, this American passport is obviously a fake. And I said, it's a fake? I said, it's an American passport with my picture. He said, you are obviously Egyptian. I said, all right. So anyways, the point is that mistaken identity is something I grew up with.
Right.
And so I realized that identities are really something that probably people deal with all the time, right? When you change a job, your identity does change by your title, by your status. And I thought, that's really the core of human behavior.
Right. And don't you think as you get older, it becomes a little easier to kind of peel back your identity?
You know what I want to tell even the youngest person is you have the freedom to decide your identity, even if you are mistaken for your identity all the time.
Why do you think it takes us so long to peel that back?
Because you don't realize you have that freedom. And it's because in certain situations, say discriminatory situations, you're constantly told you are not who you are. So peeling back the onion can even go across genders, so that when I deal with people in the UN, then I need to find that humanity in that person who hates me. I need to find that humanity in the other enemy. And it's in that, in a person who disagrees with me, let's put it that way, not necessarily an enemy. So when we do that, I think that's how you peel back your onion, you let it go. But you also have the right and the responsibility, let's say the responsibility, to make sure you don't put the wrong identity on someone else.
So I loved some of the things that you say in your TED Talk about the freedom for identity. What would you say to women across the country right now or across the world? How do you do that without crying? It's not easy to, you know, I think as women in particular, we do put on a show to try to show who we are. So how do you do that without crying and be your true self?
You know, I think that's really a great question for... So if you think about what happens, I was one of the organizers of the NGO forum, the UN Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. We brought together 30,000 women under these different themes. In the peace tent, you found women doing the American hokey pokey. They didn't speak each other's languages, but they found that common ground. When I say without crying, I don't mean without suffering. You can suffer through an experience, but how it affects you is the crying part. How much do you dwell there? How much do you live there? And so the freedom, I think, comes from deciding you're not going to live in the wrong identity, but you have to decide that. And I genuinely believe we have the freedom to do that, that is the most basic freedom we have as a human being, is to decide who we are. And in that peace tent where they were doing the hokey pokey together, they decided that no matter what suffering they were going through, they were all the same person. And that gave them the solace, that gave them the comfort and an empowerment that we talked about at lunchtime, that gave them the empowerment they needed to going.
So you've spent years peeling back your onion. Who are you now? What is your identity now, would you say?
You know, I thought about that in various situations. Today, I'm an Asian American person who came from Hoboken, New Jersey to talk to friends and be on the WGTE public media podcast.
That's right.
Which is
today.
My first podcast. You forgot to mention my first podcast with someone in the U.S. That is who I am today. And I'm really excited and happy to be that person today. But day before yesterday, I was the WHO senior advisor, you know, things like that.
In Nairobi.
Yeah. And coming through custom, I realized coming through security today, I thought about that. So for that guy behind the desk, when I showed him my ID, my official ID, I was not the WHO advisor. I was not the Asian American. I was either a security threat or not a security threat. He didn't care. I could have said, I have a PhD in anthropology. I work for the UN, and he could care less. So identities really matter how you work with people and how you see people. And the discrimination part can come if he thought, because I was Asian American, that I was a threat.
Right.
And he would have acted on it.
And, I mean, that's kind of the world today, right?
We're
acting on what we feel is our threat. I saw in the book also your chapter on ending violence against women and girls. I know that's a passion of yours. I don't think there's a lot of us who experience what that means, but you're talking about the United States and across the world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, the concept of what violence is also very important, because it can be a kind of economic violence where you suppress someone's rights. I mean, we should think about those kinds of things because they lead and are intertwined with physical violence, which is why we talked about economic empowerment today. So women who have economic empowerment can often get out of abusive situations. And this is true around the world, which is why when we talk about ending violence against women, we also have to talk about credit. We have to talk about economic livelihoods and alternatives for them. We also have to think much more about perpetrators. So 80% of men are not violent men. But we're dealing with it as if it were a women's problem. Violence against women is not just a woman's problem, but we are rescuers. So we rush to rescue our girls from female genital mutilation. We create shelters for women. But the men who step up, the 80% of men like my husband who step up and say violence against women is wrong and men need to figure it out, that I think that's where our hope is.
Right. Absolutely, it is our hope. That kind of leads me into the CEDAW conversation. I think there's a lot of people who've never even heard of that or understand what it means. But mm-hmm. I think as we move forward as women, it plays such an important part globally. Can you explain a little bit about what that is?
Yes.
You kind of wrote the book on that,
I have an emotional attachment to CEDAW because I was with the UN Secretariat when that document came to us in Copenhagen for the Copenhagen.
And say what CEDAW
is. Right. So when I saw it, I read it. It was very short. It's a convention on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women. Ratified means it's gone through their so-called Senate in every country in 189 countries. But when we first introduced it, it was a brand new document. And it is the only document that has been ratified that upholds women's human rights. So you have human rights in many cities, human rights commissions. But what this convention does, which Toledo is amazing because it did it as an ordinance and created the CEDAW Commission. What it does is it gives it that human rights umbrella teeth for women. And it gives a roadmap because the 23 articles covers everything from violence against women to family rights, to economic rights, political rights. It covers everything very elegantly. And it's updated by experts, 23 experts who meet in Geneva, who Benita here in Toledo knows about, because we do take informal reports to them, and we did talk about Toledo in Geneva at our last meeting. So what it does is it gives you a roadmap, and it says, you know, we're dealing with violence against women, but have we really done enough on the economic side? And here is what we can do, and this becomes law. It becomes law, and we need to use it. So besides Toledo, we now have 65 other cities, counties, and states, including all the counties in Hawaii. And the star in our cap is Washington, D.C., who passed this ordinance in March. And we want to keep it in the United States because the United States is the only country that has not been able to pass it through the Senate. But we're hoping that with the Equal Rights Amendment push, Equal Rights Amendment is like three sentences. CEDAW is the roadmap. So we can use them together. And it has absolutely no meaning if it doesn't come to cities.
So I've read a lot about different places you've traveled and things that you're involved in. Like, what is your mission now?
My mission right now is you guys. It is Cities for CEDAW. Learning, it is Cities for CEDAW, learning from the innovations that are happening all across this country, because you don't, as I say, you're more special than you think you are. I think because the United States is such a powerful country, the average American citizen does not realize how much the rest of the world watches what happens here. Blue jeans. Where did blue jeans start from? Even Russians are wearing blue jeans. It happened in the United States. And people watch because the United States is powerful. And when the United States coughs, the rest of the world shakes. So we thought that if we could get a powerful instrument to become something that women in the United States can use and stand behind, and men, like your mayor, like the mayor of Los Angeles, Garcetti, like the mayor of Pittsburgh, these are amazing champions that other people are watching. And I have seen exactly, not necessarily yours, but those other mayors have come to the climate change negotiations, for example. They are engaged with global issues. So we connecting, you know, this process with the rest of the world is a natural thing, but we really think the United States needs to be the example and that you can show the way for other countries. The CEDAW expert, I mentioned this expert group from Nigeria, is dying to visit Los Angeles.
What about Toledo?
We'll bring her to Toledo. She would love it. She would love it because she wants to bring it to her parliament in Nigeria and to Abuja, which is their capital. And she just thinks it's exciting. So this is just to tell you how much other countries, important people in other countries, watch what happens in the U.S.
And, you know, we've talked about this, that the importance of, you call it intergenerational justice. Like, we have to teach everybody to speak up about this, right? This is not something that's just happening in governments or cities. This is people who are in our neighborhoods, right? Tell me a little bit about this intergenerational justice that you so firmly believe in.
So interesting. I think the strongest support for that came from the Africa region, because most of their population is young. So we have something at the UN now. We're trying to institutionalize the idea that multiple generations, not just two, you now have with an aging population three, maybe even four, who need to create spaces for each other that is much more equitable. So I mentioned previously at the lunch we had today, which was a great lunch, on economic empowerment and business, Women's Business Council, you know, that thinking of creating an event where you have half the participants under the age of 35 speaking, where you listen to their ideas, their concerns. And it's so interesting in the surveys that we see, so much of that generation is still focused on education, health. These are what we call social issues, right? But they're actually the core issues, which is how the other generation got there. That's how they became CEOs, right? It's because they got those health things, they got those education things. So it equalizes, it creates a just environment for them to grow up in, and it equalizes the balance between the generations. So that's why the word justice, I think, is there. And I think it's something that if we institutionalize it in our UN thinking, in the way we work, by the way, we've created a new office in the Secretary General's office called the Youth Office, and we will have a whole set of programs devoted to intergenerational justice.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
That's in New York, by the way.
that's awesome.
Not far.
Right, right. So, you know, there's a lot of women out there like myself who want to make a difference in our cities, in our country, in our world. And we look up to people like you who are doing the actual work. What recommendation would you give me or the other women in the room on where do we make the biggest impact and how?
Mary, as far as I'm concerned, you guys are doing the work. I'm just sitting there giving ideas, which is really true. The UN's greatest strength is giving principles and standards and ideas. It's really half of its strength. Human rights came from the United Nations. The whole concept of those things, CEDAW came as an idea. Law is basically an idea. What makes it work are people like yourself who are interested in it and who therefore translate it into local work. So as I have often said, you are more special than you think you are in making that connection. And I would say what we need to do is to learn more maybe about CEDAW, learn more about what it can offer. You now have a CEDAW commission. You could do more public education. We're going to have a 10th anniversary of the Cities for CEDAW. I forgot to mention the magic number. We now cover 80 million Americans with that. So it's 10th anniversary celebration of the Cities for CEDAW campaign through culture, the culture of peace, the culture of equality, and the culture of sustainable development, which means that we will invite artwork, poetry, theater. We already have a theme song, believe it or not, that North Carolina created. So we have to get the theme song in there. So cultural transformation is going to be the way we're going to celebrate, and we really invite Toledo to be part of that.
That's incredible. Well, I am as I said, in awe of everything that you've done. I'm grateful. I know the women in the room and the women around the world are incredibly inspired by the things that you've done for all of us and you continue to do. And I look forward to seeing what ideas you have in the future to help, literally help the world. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you, WGTE.
Even offline, Dr. Yoon's constant reminder to me that you are more special than you think you are will stay with me forever. And I'm going to do my best to pass that along and let others know that they are too. There is so much more to this amazing woman's global journey that we just didn't get a chance to touch on. But I'm so grateful she made time for us today, and even more grateful for the work that she's doing around the world. I want to thank Nina Quarter of Women of Toledo for setting up this interview, my awesome and very patient producer, Chris Pfeiffer, our incredible guest, Dr. Shun Young Yoon, and to you, our listeners, who are more special than you think you are. Please continue to like and download Women in What We Do podcast on WGTE.org/whatwedo. And always remember, speak up. We do.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.